Hello and welcome to our Food Principles module on the anti-candida diet. I'm sure you've heard of and explored and maybe even done yourself some form of an anti-candida diet. So the purpose of this presentation is to go through what the core principles are of an anti-candida diet, why you would want to do it, who you'd want to do it with, and then look at some specific variations on it and help you to be able to design for your client that you're working with a specific one that's going to work for them. Because like we always talk about, not everybody's the same, and we want to look at a personalized approach. So before we begin, this information is not intended as medical advice. It's strictly information from my clinical experience and my research to you. And if you're under the care of a doctor, you're working with someone who's under the care of a doctor on any medication, you always have to make sure that they're checking in with their doctor to make sure that this is going to work well for them. Okay, so let's just get going. So we're going to start with a definition. And the definition is a term called dysbiosis. A lot of people go around saying they have candida overgrowth or they have candidiasis, but without them actually doing testing to identify the specific organs that are overgrown in their gut, if you think somebody has an overgrowth in their gut, the better term is dysbiosis. So it's basically the presence of unfriendly gut bugs where there should be just nice, clean flora and a balance that everybody lives in symbiosis. So technically, that term means bad life in the digestive tract. And it's when the balance shifts. It doesn't mean that there's no bad guys, right? This is not a situation where only the good guys live in the gut. There's this symbiotic relationship between the good guys and the bad guys, and it's when the balance gets disrupted that we have a problem, and that's when we want to help people to restore the balance. So anything about an anti-candida diet is really about restoring balance to the gut. We call it an anti-candida diet because it's against this candida. It's really a diet that helps to restore the ecological balance in the gut to a good, friendly microbiome that's going to do all the really cool stuff that people need them to do. So the symptoms that people get when they have an overgrowth in their gut are produced by a number of things. One, it's the endotoxins produced by the bugs. A lot of these bugs produce lipopolysaccharides and other toxins that actually damage the membrane, the endothelial lining of the digestive tract. It's also interference with the functioning of the good bugs. So the good bugs like the lactobacillus species and the bifidobacter species and a whole bunch of others, they actually have a function in the gut, and that function is to produce nutrients and enzymes and help the body digest the food and protect the membrane. And when those bad guys, so to speak, get overgrown, it interferes with that good functioning, and you may see people who start to develop nutrient imbalances, poor digestive function, et cetera. And the other way the symptoms result is from gases and fermentation. So these bugs love to feed on sugar and things that turn to sugar quickly. And as a result, they're able to produce gas in the intestinal tracts, methane gas, hydrogen gas, and kind of stinky, smelly gases that are not very pleasant and why people might be coming to see you to help them get rid of it. So organisms that can cause dysbiosis, in addition to our star of the day today, which is a candida, which is really a fungus, and it's in the fungal yeast family, there are also bacteria that can be overgrown and viruses and parasites and worms. And you need to be aware of all of this. And we hit this in great detail in our digestion module on dysbiosis. And you need to be aware because a lot of folks go around and they go, I've got candida and I'm going to do some things to get rid of candida. And they do a lot of protocols to help kill off the fungus, like taking nystatin, for example, which is a pharmaceutical medication. But what it's doing is missing the whole point of restoring balance. And if it's, yeah, maybe there's a candida overgrowth, but there may also be a bacterial overgrowth, a viral overgrowth, a parasite, or even worms. And the thing about candida overgrowth is it's really hard to get rid of if there's a parasite living there. That parasite just helps to keep the lifestyle of this candida keep going and going and going. So it's really important to be looking at the entire ecology of the gut. So what exactly is Candida? Well, it's a single-celled fungus. It's a yeast, also a single-celled fungus. It covers everything. It's actually a really normal inhabitant of the human body. It's on the skin, it's in the mouth, it's in the vagina, and it's in the digestive tract. And it's fine to live there and in symbiotic conditions as long as it doesn't overgrow and overtake. But what happens is, for a number of reasons we'll discuss in a minute, which you're probably already aware of most of them, that the good flora gets killed off by some of the interventions someone might do. For example, antibiotics. They're taking antibiotics for their flu or something else that the doctor may have prescribed it for, and unbeknownst to them, they're killing off their good organisms in their gut, and they're taking away that state of balance, that symbiotic relationship between Candida and the normal and flora bacteria that we have. And so it's that balance that we're looking for. We're not looking to eradicate it. We're actually looking to get it back in balance the way it's supposed to. So in unhealthy conditions, it actually can change its shape. Instead of being this little round, jolly, benign organism, it can elongate, and it becomes a hot dog-shaped invader and grows these little tails called mycelli, which can embed themselves into the tissue. And then it allows it to grow out of control, but it also does damage to the delicate endothelial lining. And they'll give off toxins that lead to inflammation and lots of symptoms in the person where this out of balance is happening. All right. Skip the slide. Okay. I'm seeing that slide, but it's not showing up. It's showing up in my thing. Let me see if I can make it bigger. There we go. Okay. I don't know if you can see it, but I will... I'll kind of go through this. I'm not sure if you could see it, and we may have to edit it into the final recording. So there's a number of Candida species. Candida albicans is the most common, the one that inhabits that people are always talking about. So when people say I have a Candida albicans overgrowth, they may or they may not, unless they've done a culture to find out for sure what they have. About 50% of all Candida overgrowths are Candida albicans. Candida tropicalis occurs in 15 to 20%. It's less aggressive than the albicans, but still can cause problems. Candida glabrata is 15 to 20%, as is Candida parapsilosis. There's another couple that are really rare, Candida krusei, and that's actually about 1% of all Candida overgrowths, and that happens in infants. It can happen in infants that have imbalances in their immune system. And then Candida lusitaniae. Let's just say that again. Then Candida lusitaniae. It's a rare one, and it's usually only seen in septicemia, which is a system-wide infection, and pyelonephritis, which is an infection in the kidneys, in the nephrons in the kidneys. Let's see if that works. So Candida albicans is the one that mostly we hear about. It's the largest inhabitant. It lives in a friendly state in the large intestine, and it feeds the good bacteria that helps the body to stay healthy when it's in balance. But when we kill off those bacteria, it multiplies, it takes over, and it feeds on the sugars and the carbohydrates in the diet, and that's when symptoms start to occur in folks. So this is what the microbiome looks like when it's in balance. You know, if you have a healthy gut environment, there's a symbiotic relationship between the organisms and us. Even if they are dangerous organisms, when they're in symbiosis, they're not going to be dangerous. But when we tip the scale and we expose the gut to dietary stressors, emotional and mental stressors, environmental exposures, toxins in the environment, pesticides, VOCs, things like that, bisphenol A, medications, a variety of medications that disrupt the flora of the gut, and environmental toxins as well. So all of these things can tip the balance. So we have those dangerous organisms pulling and weighting it down and actually starting to cause destruction. And this is just a review from our digestion module. So what causes Candida? Again, a review. Well, antibiotics. But the antibiotics don't just exist in the prescriptions that people are taking. They exist in the foods. And people are taking antibiotics not just as prescriptions. They're like slathering them all over their skin to try to prevent infections from growing. And it disrupts the normal flora in the body by killing off the good guys as well as the bad guys. Steroid hormones. So a lot of people are on corticosteroids. Autoimmune disease is most common for it. But pretty much anybody that goes in to see a doctor for a rash on their skin is going to get some steroids. Now, those are topical steroids, so those aren't going to be as harmful for the gut, but it's going to disrupt the flora on the skin. Right? But a lot of people are taking steroids, just willy-nilly just taking those steroids. And they happen in food. So if someone's eating foods, animal products that are not organically raised, those animals have been shot up with steroids to help them beef up and become more, you know, I just lost my word there. So the antibiotics are put into the food to beef up the animals, to get them to be bigger and stronger, and they produce a better meat, actually a fattier meat, and people are eating those all the time. It's very common. So those are things that people, you know, athletes and bodybuilders are taking steroids to try to grow their muscles. The diet. The diets that feed and contribute to the candida overgrowth, we already know this. Diets high in sugar. Diets high in processed foods, you know, the candies and the cookies and the pastas and the things that are just not all real ingredients. And then protein, excess protein. Excess protein can cause an overgrowth of candida by acidifying the blood, which then acidifies the tissues, and it allows the candida to overgrow. And a lot of people get confused about that because candida get killed off by stomach acid. So if somebody has low stomach acid, then the candida is going to escape as it comes in through the mouth if you're eating it and ingesting it or passing it from one person to another. The acids in the stomach kill it. But the overall alkaline ash in the body, the alkaline residue in the body, is what's needed to keep it in balance. Then birth control pills. Birth control pills disrupt the microbiome big time. It disrupts the organisms that are living down there, and what happens is that you get imbalances in the sex hormones, which change the microbiome, which just absolutely change the whole complexion of the microbiome. People are using, like I said, antibiotic soaps and antimicrobial soaps and sanitizers. You see those as you walk into the supermarkets. It's a big thing. It says, clean your hands before you go in. Not on your life. I'm not touching that stuff. There's some chemicals in there that are very, very disruptive to hormones, as well as, you know, having the antibiotics that are disrupting our microbiome and our skin microbiome as well. Stress is a huge cause of candida overgrowth. We know the effects of stress on the digestive tract. We know that it turns down the rate of enzyme secretion, the rate of stomach acid secretion, the secretion of bile, the activity, the motility of the system. So the bacteria and the organisms that are supposed to be moving down and inhabiting the large intestine sometimes get stuck inhabiting the small intestine and contributing to SIBO. And when you get a candida overgrowth in the small intestine, it can be pretty dramatic. And inflammation, when people are inflamed, when they have an imbalance of their omega-3 and 6 fatty acids, that can contribute to the overgrowth of candida. So what about candida and autoimmune disease? So it's huge, and I'm really trying to paint a picture for why it's important to understand how to identify and then work with someone who you suspect has this kind of an overgrowth. Candida infection can contribute to autoimmune disease. The overgrowth of Candida albicans is a key factor in many studies that have been done on autoimmune patients, that the Candida albicans was predominant factor in there. It triggers cravings. So if you're working with somebody who's like, just can't stop, you know, I want sugar, I want milk products, you know, cheese and things like that, they may have an overgrowth. So that's a symptom for you to be aware of that makes you suspicious that they may have it. It may not just be an emotional eating pattern that they've developed and they're feeling sad or lonely. Here's the thing. We talked about it being a nice, round, jolly little organism in its normal, healthy state, and that elongated hot dog-type state, the fungal state with the mycelae. Well, the mycelae, they bore holes into the gut. They create this state of gut dysbiosis, and they create leaky gut. And so it's really important that we address this, because when you have leaky gut, then a lot of the undigested proteins or larger proteins before they get fully digested pass into the bloodstream, creating an immune response. And it can cause cross-reactivity with a variety of different organisms, and it's one of the theories about the pathogenesis of autoimmune disease, that without leaky gut, autoimmune disease doesn't happen. When we look at people with autoimmune disease, and leaky gut is just a very big correlation there. And it can lead to all kinds of symptoms that you may not even recognize as being related to their gut, like depression, thyroiditis, autoimmune thyroiditis would cause depression, listlessness, tiredness, extreme fatigue, that hungover feeling in the morning. All of these can be attributed to an overgrowth here and the coexistence of autoimmune disease. And then there's a lot of other infections that can exist along with candida that they feed on each other and they help each other to grow. And if you've got a parasitic infection and you've got a candida overgrowth, they're going to feed each other. And you've got to be able to get rid of both of them instead of just working on one. So this is just kind of setting the stage for you. So how do you know if someone needs an anti-candida diet or an anti-dysbiosis diet, as it might better be labeled? Well, symptoms. We have them fill out the questionnaires, and you have questionnaires that you can have them fill out. You've got a leaky gut questionnaire. You've got a candida overgrowth questionnaire. So you find out their history, you know, their history of antibiotic use, of steroid hormone use, of birth control use, their history of eating a lot of sugary foods, their cravings for sugary foods, and their symptoms, which may be gut-related, but they also may be systemic, and we'll look at some of those as well. You can do stool testing, which is a great way to identify what organisms are living down there. You want to do a stool test, in my opinion, do a stool test where they're checking to see the sensitivities, like what organisms are specifically there, and then which of the natural and the pharmaceutical products are actually going to get rid of it. Because a lot of times these bugs develop resistance. They outsmart us, and we want to be able to look at that. A spit test, that's a questionable test. So some people say you take a glass of water first thing in the morning, you spit into it, and if you get stringy things coming down, then that's a sign of candida overgrowth. It's out there as a possibility. I'm not quite sure of the reliability of something like that. There's a breath test. You can do a breath test for fermentable products in the gut. You can do an antibody test. You actually test for candida antibodies. You can do an organic acid test. One of the byproducts that they produce is diarabinol, and we look at diarabinitol. We look to see if there's signs of that and how much of that is actually in an organic acid test. And the other thing you can do, and this is not, you know, a medically sanctioned scientific one, but kinesiologic testing is a very common way to identify it. You just have to be super careful if you're doing it or you're working with somebody who is doing it, that they're really clearing, you're clearing yourself, they're clearing themselves, because your opinion can affect the muscle testing results. So if you're expecting a certain result, you can actually just push that in that result, in that direction that you want it to be. So I think it's really, this works well when you're clear about it. A lot of times if you're going to do something like that, I like to do blind testing where neither the tester or the person knows what's being tested until after the result has been obtained. And that's another whole conversation. So how do you know if you have someone who would be a good candidate for going on an anti-candida diet? Well, a lot of the digestive symptoms, of course, this could be a lot of other things as well, but if they have a bunch of digestive symptoms, bloating, gas, diarrhea, constipation, abdominal pain, burning in the esophagus, so reflux, but that could just be caused by something else, by a hiatal hernia or other things. Itching and burning in the rectum, that could be a parasite. That could also be a candida overgrowth. Burping. Okay, so see, there, you just have to pull it all together and decide, and if you're not going to do the stool testing, then it doesn't hurt to put someone on an anti-candida diet for a while to try to get their microbiome under control. So systemic symptoms, headaches, muscle pains, fatigue, allergy symptoms, male and female disorders. So if you're seeing a bunch of these different things, you suspect it. not everybody with anxiety or depression or ADD is going to have a candida overgrowth, but there's a really good likelihood that they do, and there's an even better likelihood that if they've been to a lot of practitioners, especially conventional medical practitioners, that these things have been overlooked, that they've had the MRIs done, they've had their blood testing done, and nothing's showing up. It may very well be that we need to address their microbiome. The biggest indication is some number of these symptoms with a history that would predispose them, with a history of the antibiotic use, steroid use, birth control pill use, hormone replacement therapy in menopausal women, and then, of course, the sugar intake and the sugar and refined carbohydrate intake. So what's the basis? What does most anti-candida diets look like? There's going to be variations. There's some that are super, super strict about having any kind of yeast in the diet or mushrooms or anything like that, and others that are more lenient that are mostly stopping the feeding of them. But most of them will include the elimination of refined carbohydrates, alcohol, fruit juice, and for the most part, things like dried fruit and fruits. So all the sugars and anything that creates sugar, basically. Most of them include taking some antimicrobial herbs along with the food. So whether they're as capsules or whether they're as teas or whether they're mixed into the foods or essential oils, but those kinds of antimicrobials are a good thing. And then probiotics to reseed the friendly bacteria, right? So some diets are very strict about no fermented foods, just the diet, just the probiotic supplements. Others are just don't bother with probiotic supplements. Let's do the foods. And it's really a matter of you catering this diet to a specific person. Yeah, there's a lot of books out there, and there's a lot of people picking up the books and not getting the results that they should because they don't have the intelligence of a practitioner who's getting to know them and help guide them through it. I remember going through for myself 2 years of this and that and the other thing on these anti-candida diets before I kind of like found my way, so to speak. So what are some of the popular ones? Well, way back in the 80s, Dr. William Crook was very controversial when he wrote the book The Yeast Connection. Donna Gates, she wrote that back in, I think it was the early 90s, The Body Ecology Diet. Dr. Gabriel Cousins, Rainbow Greens, Live Food Cuisine, Phase 1 is an anti-candida part of the diet. These are all books that have been made popular, and there's dozens of them. You go online, you go to Amazon, and just type in anti-candida diet, you're going to find bunches of them, and you're going to find that there's some things and some that disagree with some of the others. But really, the basics are similar. And so we're going to go through a few of these popular ones and then give you some guidelines as to how you can use this structure and determine how to put together an anti-candida diet for your clients. And I encourage you, we called it an anti-candida diet. It's really a dysbiosis diet. There are certain herbs and things that are different, whether you're dealing with a fungal, a parasite, or a bacteria. But the basis of the anti-dysbiosis diet is actually very similar. So this is a book called The Yeast Connection, written back in the 80s, very controversial, still is controversial amongst a lot of standard medical practitioners. And what it calls for is going through four distinct stages, and it's basically elimination of sugar and doing elimination diets. So you eliminate sugar and all yeast-containing foods. So Dr. Crook's version of it is you eliminate baker's yeast, brewer's yeast, you eliminate mushrooms, anything in the fungal or yeast family. Now, later people are finding that it's not necessary for a lot of people, most people even, to eliminate all of those yeast fungal kind of forms because they're very different. But it could be certainly, it can't hurt, except that it limits the diet a little bit. But then there's the challenge phase where you reintroduce and you check for reactions. Now, you're not going to reintroduce sugar and say, okay, now that you've got your organisms under control, go eat a whole bunch of sugar and let's see how you do. But it's some of those other foods, the mushrooms, the other things like that. And again, this is, I'm just passing on his diet. I'm thinking in terms of how have I modified it over the years to actually get better results with people. Then there's a reassessment. And you basically explore how people are, what food allergies, what sensitivities, take out those, do a reintroduction phase, and then maintenance, just sticking to the foods that work, right? So this kind of thing each stage, he writes, you know, certain foods are permissible and certain ones are not. And you're certainly welcome to go look at the book. It's still available, still being sold. And it, I think it's a good one to have on your shelf just because it represents, like, the early stages of this. A lot of people have written books since, and a lot of people who are just people who got better from their protocol, and they wrote a book about it, right? And that may or may not work for everyone. But, again, like I said, the basics are very similar. So this is the Body Ecology Diet, and this is a handout that you can get if you go to this link, bodyecologydiet.com, the Body Ecology Diet Blueprint, and they'll send you a PDF with this in it. I put it up here just to let you see, and I'm going to go through each of the stages in minor detail and then allow you to go through that. But it's really a nice little chart because it has the what you can eat, what to expect, snack ideas, and then the stages, the 1, 2, and 3. And what I like is the plate. I really like looking at the plate because in this book they talk a lot about the 80-20 rule, right? 80% of the diet should be vegetables, non-starchy vegetables, and alkalizing foods. 20% can be, you know, meats or certain allowable grains and certain allowable seeds, depending on the stage that you're in. And a lot of cultured foods in this diet, a lot of cultured foods. Fats and oils are allowed. They have to be unprocessed and pure. Her recommendation is 60 to 65% of the body weight in fluid ounces of water. I always say half your body weight. She's actually going for a little bit more. And the only fruits that are allowed, at least in the first phase, are the sour fruits. The first phase is actually the anti-candida part of it. And you're actually persons on that for until they don't have to be on it anymore. So in an overview of what it looks like, phase one, that's then there's phase two, and there's a focus in all stages on probiotic-rich foods, coconut, kefir, cultured vegetables. There's an emphasis on food combining, like not combining starches and protein in the same meal because it taxes the digestion. Right? Always having your starches would be had with, and those are non-gluten grains, we'll look at that in a moment, but the starches would be had with green leafy vegetables, non-starchy vegetables. The proteins would be had with green leafy vegetables, non-starchy vegetables. You wouldn't combine the two of them. And then the 80-20 rule. She has a lot of 80-20 rules, which I like. It's not like you not have to go to 100% on a lot of things, but it's 80-20. The 100% is avoidance of the sugars and the sugar-containing foods and the things that produce it. And that's on that chart. And the book is a great book. I think it's been rewritten since my version of it, which I've had for probably 20 years. So phase one of the Body Ecology Diet, it lasts for 3 to 4 months or until all overgrowth symptoms are gone. So it's really important when you're talking to your client that you don't say, okay, you're just going to do this for 3 or 4 months. I mean, they may maybe quicker, but it may be 6 months for some. And it all depends on how strict they are and adherence to it and how long-standing their problem is and what other problems might be going on in their gut. But it basically involves removal of all fruit except for lemons and limes, black currants, and cranberries. Gluten, and I don't mean you can't have the dried cranberries that are sweetened with fruit juice. No, cranberries, like fresh cranberries, are super sour. Gluten and all grains. All grains are removed during this phase. And casein, all casein is removed. They caution they prefer you not to have during this phase nuts and seeds because of the high oxalates and copper and phytates. But if you're going to have them, include them, small amounts, and they need to be soaked for 8 hours or more, 8 to 12 hours, and then rinsed. And there's particular ones that are considered okay, like she talks about in the first edition of the book anyway, almonds and sunflower seeds, to stay away from any other nuts or seeds in this first phase, but also, again, very small amounts. Recommends you leave out the beans and the legumes, but if someone, you know, if you've got somebody who's just like struggling to keep their weight on and they're like, all I'm eating is vegetables here, vegetables and a little bit of meat, I don't think it's going to cut it, then going with that. But the preference is to soak them overnight and then to sprout them before they're cooked, and that way they're most digestible. And then you stay away from the sweet, starchy vegetables completely, although a little bit of like grated carrot or beet on a salad is considered okay in this phase. And then the focus, again, probiotic-rich foods, very big on the coconut, kefir, and cultured vegetables, very important part of it. Now, for some, they may not be able to do the cultured vegetables right away. They may have a SIBO problem in that the cultured vegetables cause them to to not, well, the cultured vegetables will get stuck, the organisms in the cultured vegetables will get stuck in the small intestine and not make it all the way down to the large intestine. The other issue is if somebody has a histamine intolerance, and we'll have another talk on histamine intolerance in this program, and if somebody has a histamine intolerance, they may not be able to tolerate the sauerkraut and the cultured vegetables at this point. So you try, you work with them on what works for them. You can make nut cheeses and nut milks that are fermented. There's a lot of ways to do it. And that would be maybe not within the scope of this diet per se, but you can combine the best of other diets as well. So that's what phase one looks like. And it could be 6 months, it could be 2 months, right? It just depends on the person and how much they've been doing up until this time and how strict they decide to be. The stricter they are, the quicker the results are going to get. Phase two will start after all the symptoms of overgrowth are gone. So you would redo the Candida questionnaire to see, do they still have a lot of signs of it? Certainly, some of the questions on the Candida questionnaire are related to history, like have you been on antibiotics? Have you been on birth control pills? That's not going to change. That just contributes to their inherent risk. All right. So phase two, when you're reintroducing some of these foods that have been eliminated in phase one, it's really important that you guide people to go slowly and introduce things carefully. So low sugar fruits like berries and sour fruits, kefir. Kefir is a good one. They make coconut kefir. There's some great recipes for coconut kefir when you look at the book. Soaked almonds and sunflower seeds, soaked and then rinsed really well. Pumpkin seeds could be included as well. If you're going to do beans and legumes, soaked overnight, but also sprouted. So wait until they get a little tail before having them cook them. It's going to be so much more digestible. And then sweet, starchy vegetables, again, all in moderation and all to tolerance. And if you see a flare-up of their symptoms when they introduce one of these categories, then you need to back off. Again, focus on probiotic-rich and cultured vegetables. This is a really basic guideline to it. And this is the link, again, to where you could get their chart. So we're going to look at a Rainbow Green live food cuisine. And they have three phases, phase one, phase one and a half, and phase two. Phase one is the foundation phase. Phase one is when you're really in there to starve out these organisms and restore balance and get some good microbiome going again. Phase 1.5 introduces a little bit of grain and low sugar fruits, and then phase 2 introduces higher glycemic but minimal use of the higher glycemic, and it broadens the diet a little bit more. That's really more of the maintenance phase. So what do we leave out in the Rainbow Green? Well, similar to what we leave out in most of these anti-candida diets, all the sweeteners, honey, agave, maple syrup, etc. They leave out animal products in all the phases, so this one is a strictly plant-based diet, and that's how it differs from the body ecology. They're very similar in their approaches, the body ecology and the Rainbow Green, except the Rainbow Green is more plant-based. The body ecology is, you know, around 80% to 90% plant-based, and it can be done 100% plant-based, but then it starts to resemble much more closely the Rainbow Green. All grains are excluded except for certain ones listed in certain phases, and I'll show you that chart in a moment. There's peanuts and cottonseed and pistachios are left out. They used to leave out cashews, and I've noticed in the revision that they don't leave out cashews anymore, and maybe it's because they found sources of cashews that are not fungal because they were concerned about fungal infections on cashews. Corn is eliminated. That goes into grains, but some people don't think about corn as a grain, so I listed it separately. White potatoes, mushrooms. Now, but mushroom extracts are considered good and healing in an herbal way. So they can do mushroom extracts, but they're not supposed to eat mushrooms in this phase, in any of the phases. Coffee and any kind of caffeine, so black tea and coffee. Heated unrefined and processed oil and margarine. Heated refined and processed oils and margarines, all phases. I mean, everybody should be eliminating those things anyway. Soy sauce, namashoyo brags are eliminated in all phases here. Brewer's yeast, nutritional yeast, bottled juices, and then what they call uncontrolled fermented foods, so kombucha and rejuvelac. And the reason for that is kombucha has got a lot of popularity, but the fact is that it can be growing wild yeasts on it, and those wild yeasts can be contributing to the overgrowth problem. And then Rejuvelac, similar. Rejuvelac is made by fermented wheat berries, and it can be made with quinoa or other kinds of grains. But it's basically allowing organisms to grow, but there's no control over them, and they sometimes get out of control. And I know that places like Hippocrates Health Institute used to use Rejuvelac a lot, and they've stopped using it because they found that they really couldn't control what was growing in there, and some people were not having good reactions to it. So this is what they avoid on all phases, and this is how you can get a copy. It's a great book, so I love that book. I keep it in my kitchen because it has some great recipes as well. But if you go to that link, dramarie.com/go/rainbowgreen, you'll be able to get access to this chart. It's actually a two-page chart, but I gave you the summary page of it, which just outlines the phase one, two, and one and a half and two. And then with phase two, there's minimal use. So I'll just pull that up a little bit closer on another chart, but I highly recommend you go there and get that chart because it's a good resource for you. So phase one, that's your foundation. That's where you're really trying to create an environment where these guys can't grow anymore and also kind of get rid of them. Don't feed them, starve them. So all grains, all fruit, all sweeteners of any kind are eliminated with the exception of stevia, xylitol, and erythritol. And if people are having severe bloating, they should be eliminating, or diarrhea, they should probably be eliminating the xylitol and the erythritol as well. Most of the diet is vegetables, green leafies and sprouts and sea vegetables and lots of herbs, and the recipes are actually delightful. I've made a whole bunch of them, and they're actually really, really good. You're allowed non-sweet fruits, which are not really, they're botanically fruits, but they're not really fruits, like tomatoes, cucumbers, red bell pepper, lemons, and limes. Those are all allowed. Sweeteners that are allowed are stevia, xylitol, erythritol. Soaked and sprouted nuts and seeds, so making sure to soak and then rinse them, with the exception of the pistachios and peanuts, which aren't really a nut anyway. They used to limit cashews, but it looks like they've changed their tune on that. Cold-pressed oils, so coconut and other cold-pressed oils are fine. And then teas, various teas, herbal teas, fermented foods, so they have recipes in there for seed milks and seed cheeses that are really, really good for this and helping to restore the microbiome. Legumes, sprouted, but they find that in this phase one, only lentils, garbanzos, and mung will keep the blood sugar steady. So small amounts of sprouts. So you can make sprouts from the lentils, garbanzos, and mung. That gives extra protein and amino acids as well. Put on a salad can be very good. But again, to tolerance, some people may not tolerate them well. And then they have a variety of supplements, some mushroom extracts, herbs, algae, and others. So they're all intended to help the person restore. And you can combine any set of herbs that you feel the person needs based on their specific condition. So that's phase one. And phase one, again, can last 6 weeks. It can last 3 months. It lasts as long as you need to help people get their symptoms under control. Phase one and a half. Anything that you had on phase one, but you can add to it some raw carrots, beets, and squash, you know, grate it up and put in a salad. Berries, cherries, sour fruits, and green apple and grapefruit can all be added. Like orange comes in the next phase, but these are the lower sugar ones. Non-gluten grains like quinoa, millet, buckwheat, teff, and amaranth, preferably sprouted. Like, you could sprout quinoa and then cook it. You can soak overnight. Millet doesn't really sprout. Buckwheat sprouts beautifully, and you can make it into grass. But you can also just sprout it so it has a little tail, and then you can turn it into things like granola or make it into crackers and things like that. Teff and amaranth are, again, they're non-gluten grains, so no gluten on any phases here. You can add kidney black and garbanzo beans. Again, well, garbanzo beans more in a way of eating them, cooked, I guess. A kidney and black bean, but again, it's going to be to tolerance, because if they're raising the blood sugar, they're probably feeding the candida. So this is after they've been through a phase where they've really gotten things under control, and then you move to phase one and a half. This is not in an active overgrowth state. And then you add the condiments like carob and mesquite and cacao oil and butter. I've even seen some of their recipes have a few cacao nibs in them. Coconut meat cultured and kefir. Now, they leave out the coconut in the first phase because the coconut meat and the liquid can be high glycemic. So that's my guess on why they leave it out in phase one, but it's introduced in phase two. And then a bunch of superfoods, whatever, you know, you want to go with, the ones they have listed on the chart are maca, goji, pomegranate, pea pollen, and mangosteen. But again, it's to the person's tolerance. I like to add the addition of test their blood sugar because that's going to give you an idea of who it's feeding. If their blood sugar is going up quickly, it means that their food's getting converted to it quickly and they can be contributing to the candida overgrowth. And then there's phase two, where to the phase one and 1.5 foods, you can add things like raw sweet potatoes, parsnips, and rutabaga. Well, you can do those grated on a salad. You can also soak them in massage them a bit and then put seasonings on them and dehydrate them to make chips. But again, you want to watch how people are doing. Coconut, peaches, pears, plums, apples, and oranges are the higher glycemic foods or the medium glycemic foods. Some of the sweeteners that person might tolerate at this level are yacon and lacuma and inulin, which inulin is a prebiotic. And then minimal. If they're going to try to bananas and pineapples and mango and papaya and dried fruits and raisins and all the like, and there's a whole list there, then it's got to be minimal and, in my opinion, check to make sure their blood sugar isn't going up. But if they say they eat it, they have a banana, but then they feel bloated and gassy or depressed or headachy or anything at all, it's really important during any of these reintroduction phases, whichever type of anti-candida diet you do with them, that you go slowly. And then diluted carrot juice. I'm not a big fan of diluted carrot juice for anybody who's had a history of insulin resistance, or diabetes. So, again, it's that really careful. And then small amounts with the cooked starchy vegetables, just small amounts. So anything from minimal use of down is very, very careful, very, very small amounts, very careful. So what foods to avoid on the anti-candida plan? Well, the obvious stuff, right? Sugar, gluten, dairy, refined carbs, all the allergens, caffeine, alcohol, trans fats, heated processed alkalized fats, they all contribute to inflammation, and we're trying to get inflammation down. The processed meats, bacons and the ham and salami and those sorts of things. Some people, nightshades need to be avoided. Lectins, some people are sensitive to those lectins and can actually contribute to the overgrowth. And then FODMAPs. So some people are really sensitive to those, and we've had a whole lecture on FODMAPs that you can watch and remember, but the fermentable oligodimonosaccharides and polyols. So those are all things that some people need to avoid. So that's where it's so important to be able to sit with somebody and customize and get a lot of feedback from them as to how it's going. Elimination diets. I can't say enough about elimination diets for so many things. It just helps to restore the gut flora. It helps to restore the integrity of the intestinal lining. It's just really, really a good one. So I always tell people, just get off gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts for a few weeks, and then if you want to add some of them back, not the gluten, not the dairy for a while, but if they want to start to add things back, you can try it. But you always want them to add things back once they've gotten to a new baseline. So if their baseline is they have, you know, 8 out of a scale of 10 headaches 3 times a week, and they get bloated after, you know, every night at dinner, and they get a skin rash a couple of days a week, it comes and then it goes. Those are some symptoms. So now you're looking for a new baseline. Maybe the new baseline is they only get a headache once a week. And they only get bloated twice a week. That's a new baseline. So personally, I like to see them all the way better before I start adding allergens back in. But you at least have to get them to a new baseline that's very noticeably different than where they started before you start to add things back so that you know the difference, right? Does that make sense? I think it's important stuff. You can also add to their foods and add to any antimicrobial, antidysbiotic, anti-candida diet, any of these herbs or foods that can be incorporated in their food or in tinctures or in teas or things like that. Any of the berberine-containing herbs, bayberry, Oregon grape, golden seal, oregano, either as oregano added to food, fresh, dried, oregano oil. Turmeric's amazing. Turmeric can be whole fresh. It can be added dry. Thyme, propolis, fennel, neem, sage, these all have really good antimicrobial properties, and it's a matter of figuring out for a person, not to give them this list and make them do all, but figure out what might be the easiest to get them to try. If you have somebody who's super sensitive to bitter tastes, then you're not going to want them to add some of these bitter ones into their foods. Okay, so the others are pumpkin seeds and pumpkin seed oil have antimicrobial properties, coconut oil, the caprylic acid, pomegranate juice. You got to be careful of blood sugar and also feeding the yeast. So that would be a later stage, not an early stage. Rosemary, garlic, pas de arco, grapefruit seed extract, undecylenic acid. That's usually from castor bean oil, and artemisia and black walnut. Those are more for the parasites. But if you've got somebody who just isn't responding as well as you think they should and they're being really clean with their diet, then I would be looking for a parasite that's lurking in there, and maybe some artemisia and black walnut, and then cloves for the eggs would be a good protocol for that. Okay, and we have all that outlined in the digestion module. So essential oils that you can have them add to their water, to their teas, to their soups, a lot of ways you can do it. So carrot seed, celery seed, coriander seed, cinnamon. I just put some cinnamon in my Slippery Elm tea that I'm drinking here. Tastes delicious. Eucalyptus, oregano, citronella, bergamot, basil, cardamom, geranium, bay laurel, lemongrass, orange, patchouli, marjoram. Now, you're not going to be able to find all of these essential oils at your local health food store. Maybe if they have a really nice herb shop in town, but there's places that you can buy them. There's doTERRA, there's Young Living, there's Living Libations, even Mountain Rose Herbs has some of them. All edible, right? You want them to say edible. If they don't say they're edible, it's either that the company is extracting them using hexane and other solvents, and you don't want that, and then that's making them not edible, or that the company hasn't really done the research to figure out which ones are edible, and they're afraid that people are going to take too much. This is it. Like, an essential oil is strong. So if somebody pours, like, instead of putting a drop of peppermint oil in a cup of tea, they pour, you know, like a whole bunch of it, it can burn their mouth and their tongue, and then they're going to come and, you know, call you for, why did you make me do this, right? So a lot of the companies are scared of that kind of thing, and so they shy away from calling some of them edible. But my main concern with the ones that don't say they're edible is that they may be extracted with hexane and other kinds of solvents. So what do people eat when they're on an anti-candida diet? Well, they eat really good, wholesome, healthy foods. Yay! Greens, fresh fruits, low glycemic, of course, and vegetables. Fresh fruits on the early stages would be considered lemons and limes, and if they tolerate maybe a little bit of blueberry, but oftentimes at least that first month is going to be no fruit at all or very, very minimal. Green juices, not the carrot juice, not beet juice, but green juices. Sea vegetables, the microalgae, all of these are super nutrient dense and help to restore the ecology of the gut. Raw and living foods as much as they can. Now, some people with disrupted guts cannot do living foods, raw foods, unless they're really blended up real fine or juiced, because they have irritation to the gut lining, and the cellulose is pretty powerful. The cell walls of plants are pretty powerful, and it can actually disrupt if the gut is not in good shape. So you just watch with that. But you want to get them as much raw and living food in there because of the enzymes. So if they can't eat them, but certainly juicing them or making fermented nut milks can be very helpful. And then, of course, there's the fermented foods, the sauerkraut, cultured vegetables, kimchi, kefir, yogurt, natto, miso. Those all can be good. You got to watch sensitivities and allergies, right? So if somebody is sensitive to soy, they may be sensitive to natto or miso. Usually not, because I've worked with people who are super sensitive to soy. The fermented forms, the natto and the miso, are fine, and they provide a lot of really good flora to rebalance. Healthy fats like coconut and avocado. Coconut contains caprylic acid, which is a known antifungal. Flax, chia, they provide mucilage, which really helps to support the lining of the gut. And they have some minor antimicrobial properties. Hemp seeds have omega-3s, which help with inflammation, so they can help it. Nutritive herbs and supplements as needed. There's long lists. I gave you a long list of some of those herbs, and then there's the nutritive herbs like nettles and horsetail and alfalfa and a lot of the others that are just loaded with nutrition. And digestive enzymes really make sure that they're digesting things well. Otherwise, they're providing fuel for the overgrowth. And so I make sure that they get many cooked or complex raw food meals that they're taking digestive enzymes. And some foods that help to reinoculate, you've seen this before, the cultured vegetables, the kimchi, the sauerkraut, any vegetables can be done. You just throw them in a crock with some extra probiotics, chop them up small, bat them down with a baseball bat, and you can make it. We've got tons of recipe videos on the site that you can take a look at. Making yogurts. I love making yogurt. Coconut yogurt, cashew yogurt, nut yogurt, seed yogurt. I haven't done this yet, but a friend of mine told me she was making sunflower seed yogurt. And it's really, sunflower seeds are a really good source of phospholipids. And I get, oh, good. I get people to take sunflower lecithin, but boy, I can get them to eat some coconut yogurt and hit the probiotics at the same time. So you can do any nut or seed. I've done hemp seeds. I've done Brazil nuts, cashews, macadamia nuts. I've done a whole number of different ones. Beverages. The kefir, I love that, making it. It's really pretty easy to make. You can make your own or you can buy it. There's a lot of places. I get the Inner Echo is a good coconut kefir, loaded with probiotic organisms. Kevita, it's got a fair amount, and that's a really nice, refreshing beverage. Kombucha, you know, people say it's a good source, but it also can contain wild yeast, which can make it worse. So I would shy away from that, at least in the early stages. If a person's really hung up on doing it, then let them do without it for a while and then reintroduce it. And plus, the kombucha can also contain alcohol. The fermentation process can produce alcohol, and alcohol feeds yeast. So that may not be the best choice. Rejuvelax, same thing, because of the wild stuff. So, again, I wouldn't do those in the early stages, but you can certainly add them back later. And then the fermented soy. I'm not a big fan of soy in its regular form, but fermented, it can be so helpful, the natto, the miso, the tempeh, in restoring the good microbiome. So supplementation with probiotics, again, it's going to be very specific. So it's a good thing to do if they're not really keen on making fermented vegetables or eating fermented vegetables. And so you've got to look at this, but some of these will feed SIBO. So you've got to be careful if they do have that immediate bloating after eating in addition to having the candida-type symptoms. You've got to watch out for that. So Acidophilus and Reuteri, Thermophilus, and Helvetica. I know Helvetica is one that's D-lactic acid-free, so that one will not feed the gut overgrowth in the small intestine, but I know the Acidophilus will and the Thermophilus maybe, so look those up. Bifidus, really potent inhabitant, and it's supposed to be a primary inhabitant, but it's not in most people, so most of the Bifidus species are just fine. So when in doubt, just give them a straight Bifidus. You know, it could be a multi-strain Bifidus, Bifidus infantis, Bifidus, there's a number of them. And then Saccharomyces is a possibility, but some people do develop a sensitivity to that. L-spirogenes, that's a spore form. It's not a normal inhabitant, as is Saccharomyces, but it helps with the competition. It helps to create space for the good guys to grow. And then, of course, there's a lot of mixed strains. So it's really working with people, and sometimes you need to have them try different ones and different probiotic-containing foods, but also different probiotics to find the one that works for them. So don't give up on it when they say, oh, I can't take probiotics. I took probiotics before, and it made my situation worse. It may be that they took the wrong kind for them, and it's worthwhile to spend some time to ask them what were the strains that they used before. Some prebiotic foods, right? Prebiotics actually feed the good guys in our gut. They don't get digested by us. We don't have the bacteria to break them down, or we don't have the enzymes to break them down. The bacteria break them down, and so they gobble them up. So these can actually feed and nourish the probiotics. So this could be a really good part of an anti-candida diet, is Jerusalem artichoke, chicory, dandelion. Acacia gum is often found in some of the protein powders. Dandelion root, wild yam, jicama, burdock, onions, garlic, leeks, asparagus, and yacon. But again, you're personalizing this to each person. Some people have problem with sulfur metabolism. Oftentimes there's a genetic imbalance in those pathways, and they don't tolerate onions or garlics and other kinds of sulfur-containing foods. So again, you feed it. If somebody has a FODMAP sensitivity where they actually don't, the gut flora is so messed up that they are taking, the bad guys are eating these foods, like especially if it's a SIBO situation, then you got to be careful with the prebiotic-containing foods. And it's just testing with each person, just customizing that diet. These are some foods that contain inulin for people who are looking for that sweetener. Generally, I wouldn't recommend these in the early stages, but in the later stages can be helpful, you know, once you've gotten them cleaned up. But I certainly wouldn't do this in a stage one, phase one of any of these diets, all right? But there's a lot of these out there. Inulaflora, that's Jerusalem artichoke, the sunroot, which is a Jerusalem artichoke syrup, there's parsnip powder. I mean, there's all sorts of things, yakan. And it's a matter of finding something if they really, really feel like they need that sweet taste. But again, in those early stages, I would do the stevia. I would add Lohan to those. I think Lohan just wasn't around when those books were written. So I think Lohan would be a good low glycemic sweetener. In fact, that's one of my favorites. And sugar alcohols you do have to be careful about, even though they do include it in the body ecology and in the rainbow green. You do have to be careful because some people are sensitive to them. So stevia and Lohan seem to be the best in those early stages. But really getting people used to not needing that sweet taste, which is easier said than done, right? So prebiotics, the danger is that they sometimes can feed the bad bugs as well as the good, causing bloating and gas and aggravate SIBO. So you really just have to pay attention. And always, see, you know, your patients, your clients are going to give you the information you need to be able to help them. They are going to be able to say, hey, this is what's happening in my body. And a lot of times a typical MD type of person will say, oh, just keep taking it, you'll get used to it. If somebody says they had a reaction to a medication or something, just keep taking it, it's no big deal, you'll get used to it, it's good for you. You just want to listen. What they tell you about what works and what doesn't work is so telling and so helps you to figure out what the mechanisms are so that you can better help them. So if they say, you know, every time I've tried erythritol or every time I've tried Jerusalem artichoke or every time I've tried inulin, I just can't tolerate it, I get bloated and gas. You can suspect that they may have a SIBO situation going on, right? And don't make them keep trying. Don't say, just keep trying. I had someone who came to see me for, she had been to a practitioner who was helping her with leaky, supposedly helping her with leaky gut, and put her on glutamine. And she didn't do very well. She felt agitated, headachy, and he goes, oh, it's just a detox reaction. Keep increasing it. And he had her keep increasing her glutamine till she was on a humongous amount, I don't know, like 10,000 milligrams a day, some amazing amount of this glutamine. And she just kept getting worse and worse and worse, and her brain got agitated. She just stopped. She stopped and found a new practitioner, which happened to be me. And I'm like, oh, my God, that practitioner wasn't listening. That practitioner went in with the dogma in mind that this stuff is good and I need to get her to take as much as she can. Wasn't listening. So I really urge you to listen to people. What they tell you about what works and what doesn't work helps guide you to create a program that's going to be the best for them. It's telling you what's going on in their body. You may not understand it all the time, but you can take that information, you can look it up, you can bounce it by us in the community, and you can get your answers. So probiotics, like, just, yeah, what's wrong with taking probiotics? Just get people on as much as they can. Wrong. Because if you're taking the wrong kind, if they're taking the D-lactic acid formers and they're eating every 2 hours, their migrating motor complex isn't working. And so their bacteria isn't being shuttled down to the large intestine where it belongs. It's getting stuck in the small intestine and can cause SIBO situations, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. It can also, they can migrate back up into the small intestine if the ileocecal valve is weak. So if they take them and it goes down through, but then they back flush, that's a more rare situation, but it definitely can happen. And then, of course, the overload of D-lactic acid, which can produce fatigue and neurologic symptoms. So if you're working with somebody that, I can't tolerate probiotics, I get really weak, or my legs and arms start to tingle, it could be related to an overload of D-lactic acid. Okay, so all of these things are things for you to keep in mind as you're putting together programs with people. I don't want it to paralyze you, like, oh, I can't do this and I can't do that. What if they this or that? These are situations that aren't common, but they happen often enough that it's worth bringing up to make sure that you are aware of what can happen. And listen, listen, listen. Just really connect and really listen to what they're saying. And you'll be able to just outline a program. program that's going to work best for them. So other considerations, transit time is really important to optimize. You want to make sure that they're well hydrated. As I said earlier, in the body ecology diet, they talk about 60 to 65% of the person's body weight in fluid ounces. I start with 50, but at least 50, and most people aren't drinking that much. They're just like, oh, yeah, I drink 3 or 4 cups of water a day. How much do you weigh? Oh, 150. That's not enough, right? Optimizing the peristalsis. So this is an important consideration while they're doing this anti-candida diet, is making sure that after their meals, they massage, they get things moving, they exercise on a regular basis. Elimination with colonics, enemas, or other things that move things through. And then really helping that migrating motor complex to work by separating the meals 4 to 6 hours. That's good for blood sugar as well. Avoiding eating before bed, because the migrating motor complex now has this long period where it can be working and healing, and it can't because it doesn't get engaged until 3.5 hours after the last meal. So it's really important not to eat right before bed. And there's prokinetic herbs. Prokinetic herbs are herbs that help to support that migrating motor complex to move things along, things like trefala and ginger, and anything that helps with serotonin production. So some of the formulas actually have 5-HTP and vitamin B6 in them to help with the prokinetics to move things along. These are really important considerations. You want to optimize these things. And so there's a lot to consider. You know, the diet is not that complicated, but it's challenging for people to do because it's different. But it's really all these other considerations and helping them with the psychology of actually doing it and helping them to personalize and optimize it for them. And this, on a last note, this is just a few extra things you might consider to add with the diet. Iodine has actually been found to be helpful to kill organisms, to kill off candida. 7% solution, that's pretty high. But you do have to be careful of not giving somebody too much iodine, because an iodine overload can be problematic and cause goiter and can aggravate Hashimoto's. So before I do iodine, I'm really careful, and I always do an iodine load test with people. Olive leaf extract, the olorupin. I'm not sure I understand how to say that word, but the olive leaf extract, the active ingredient in olive leaf extract, can be very helpful as an anti-candida agent. It's also very good at balancing blood sugar. It helps to increase insulin sensitivity. Colloidal silver, you know, that has controversy around it, but for some folks it can work really well as an antifungal. Silicon, so something like Biosil, or even something, well, I don't know if the horsetail has a lot of silicon, but you might want to get a supplement if you're trying to actually kill candida. A wormwood is an antiparasitic. It can help with the candida, and it also helps with the parasites. Vitamin D in large amounts can actually have fungicidal activity, as can vitamin C. And vitamin C in large amounts can pretty much kill off everything. There have been lots of studies where they show what the person's lungs look like before the vitamin C and gave them IV vitamin C, and afterwards, like, the infections were gone in 48 hours. So pretty dramatic. Caprylic acid in coconut. If you want to concentrate the caprylic acid in a culinary oil, you can go for MCT oil, or one that's super concentrated in just the caprylic. It's a little more expensive, is the Bulletproof Brain Octane. It's a pretty good one. And then antifungal herbs that we discussed, any others that we discussed in the Clinical Mastery of the Digestive System. So that's it for our anti-candida diet protocol. As you hopefully see by now, it's a lot more than just killing off a particular fungal form or yeast form. It's more about restoring balance to the gut. And the diet and the lifestyle that we've presented here is very helpful for restoring that balance and getting your clients to have a good microbiome, a healthy microbiome that's going to support overall body health and hormone balance.